Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We're broadcasting from the AFP International Conference in San Antonio. And before I introduce my guest, I want to remind everyone that the How Fundraising Really Works Roadshow is underway. We will be in Philadelphia at the YMCA of Greater Philadelphia on Friday, April 5th, and we will be at St. Augustine's University in Raleigh, North Carolina on Friday, April 26th. If you'd like more information about either of those upcoming events, please check out the show notes. My guest here, I've just caught him after his presentation, is Russell James. Russell is the professor in the Department of Personal Financial Planning at Texas Tech. He directs the on-campus and online graduate program in charitable financial planning, planned giving. Dr. James has published research in over 40 different peer-reviewed scientific journals and has been quoted on charitable giving and financial issues in a variety of news sources, including The Economist, The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, and The Chronicle of Philanthropy. Russell, we're here to talk about storytelling and planned giving. So why don't you just sort of kick us off there for a minute? What did we talk about here at the conference that's interesting. You're putting those two and two together, and I don't know that I've had anybody do that, so that this will be an interesting conversation.
Well, great. Sure. So, you know, I mean, as a professor, we like to get into all sorts of crazy technical details and methods and all of that. But really, I think there's one key idea that is very helpful in fundraising in general. And really, it's a key idea that can transform everything that you do. And that very simple idea is to advance the donor's hero story. And now that concept of advancing the donor's hero story may seem initially very simple, but there's actually a lot hiding in each word. When we are talking about the donor identifying with a hero as the hero or with the hero, which is a sacrificial protector of group members or values, and how we can use story to advance that notion. But you point out the very accurate comment that it's rare to see this storytelling combined with the field of planned giving.
Right.
Where did that start? Well, yeah. I'll tell you what, it actually relates to some of the neuroimaging research I've done here at Texas Tech University, at the Texas Tech Neuroimaging Institute. So what we did is we wanted to understand more about how people make planned giving decisions, in particular gifts and charitable gifts and wills. And we noticed that there was this huge behavioral difference where even among those who donate substantial amounts, who are over age 50, fewer than 10% of those folks included any gift to charity in their estate plans. So we wanted to learn what's different about this decision. What is special about that charitable bequest decision? And in a now published academic paper, what we've learned is that this decision for the charitable bequest decision, it involves what you might think of as visualized autobiography. In other words, people are engaging in visualization. They're engaging in taking an outside perspective on themselves. The same sorts of mental activities or neurological activations that we see when people are mentally traveling back in time or recalling autobiographical personal events. Not only do we see that, but as this visualization, as this internal visualization increased, it actually predicted an increased likelihood of willingness to include a gift in a will to that particular charity. Now, this, in a sense, isn't the only time this result has come up. My co-presenter and co-author, Dr. Claire Ratley from the United Kingdom, she also wanted to understand why people pick the charities they pick to be in their will documents. But instead of using a $3 million neuroimaging machine like I did, she used a different approach, which is she just asked them.
Right.
And what she found as a result of a large series of qualitative in-depth interviews is that, to quote from her dissertation, when discussing which charities they had chosen to remember, there was a clear link with the life narratives of many respondents. So it appears that the charitable bequest decision is all about the donor's life story. So what can we do with that? Well, just as an example, we had a series of experiments that tested a variety of different marketing messages to see what was most powerful at shifting people's attitudes about making a gift and a will to a charity. And we tested this for 40 large national charities. And so we tested various messages, some that shared statistics about how, you know, honestly, the kids are probably going to blow that inheritance in about 9 months anyway, so why not do something charitable with it? And that had a little bit of an effect. We tried some messages that showed how other people agreed with the concept, showing some statistics on that. And that helped a little bit more. And for some groups, we even had them go through both sets of messages. But we didn't actually start really changing people's attitudes until we started sharing stories. At first, we shared brief 75-word stories about deceased people who had left a gift and how that gift continued to make an impact, and that had a positive effect. But the effect got much, much better when we used those identical stories, but we changed them from stories of deceased people to stories of living planned bequest donors, and then the gift would take place in the future. So those living bequest donor stories were, among all the messages we tested, they were the most powerful kind of marketing messages for changing people's attitudes. The surprising thing is that those stories, they worked for all 40 of the different national charities we tested. Even if the stories weren't about that particular cause, the stories were about the idea that we include a gift in a will to reflect our life story. And so that concept was very powerful. And in fact, the more stories we shared, the more people became relatively interested in a charitable gift in a will. We've actually been able to take this information and use it to change the way that we describe the gift. Let me give you kind of an example. If we just ask people about if they're interested now in making a gift to charity in your will, we get about 30% of folks have some level of interest now in doing that. Now, we can make that result worse if we use technical terms. So if we ask people about their interest in making a bequest gift to charity, that number drops down to about 12%. But we can actually bump the number higher if we use the magic phrase. Now, the magic phrase is that instead of just asking about their interest in making a gift to charity in your will, we ask about their interest in making a gift to charity in your will to support a cause that has been important in your life. Now, notice that the reason I call that the magic phrase is whenever we add that to any description of a planned giving instrument, it bumps up people's interest in making those kinds of gifts. So the reason that we came up with that phrase, to support a cause that hasn't been important in your life, is because we see from the neuroimaging that when people are making these charitable gift and will decisions, they are actually engaged in this life review process. And so what we're doing is we're encouraging that review process by adding that phrase, to support a cause that has been important in your life. And by using that description of the gift, make a gift to charity in your will to support a cause that has been important in your life, we're now able to bump up to 40% of people being interested now to some extent in making that kind of a gift. So this is how the neuroimaging interacts with the phrasing. And in fact, we also had a series of tests where we looked at different survey questions. And in other words, the issue was what sorts of questions should you ask people before you ask them about their interest in making a gift in a will. And of all of the different question series we tested, the most powerful, the most effective question series was asking about the person's life connections to the cause. So, for example, we tested this with regard to a couple of very large nationally known environmental charities, and the powerful questions were things like, at what age did you first begin to think about the importance of conserving the natural environment? Or which of the following have been important in your life? Time I've spent outdoors, time I've spent in a forest or on a river, my life experiences with wildlife or wild birds, trees or plants. These kinds of questions that evoke this, what you might call visualized autobiographical connections to the cause, they were the most powerful messages in terms of bumping up people's interest in making a gift and a will. In some brand new research, and this actually is just being published within the last month or so, we tested the same type of information. The only difference was, in some conditions, we would tell people about the charitable cause or about specific charitable projects. And in other groups, we didn't tell them, we instead asked them about the identical causes or projects. In other words, we asked them to rate the importance of those causes or to rate the importance of the specific projects of the charities. And what we found is that if you ask people to rate the importance of the cause or the particular projects, their subsequent interest in actually making a charitable gift or a gift in a will to support that organization or similar organizations goes up significantly as compared to telling people those same things. This is the idea that when we're interested in advancing the donor's hero story, we've got to start with the donor's story itself. What is important to them? And we start not by telling, we start by asking and listening.
So now, Russell,
there are a few other
Go ahead. Yeah, so I've been fascinated with this whole concept of story structure recently looking at my own marketing plans for my small firm, and I think it's quite fascinating that the way that you're sort of incorporating story structure with science and with what we know about charitable giving. But I've got a question for you. It's sort of one of those questions that maybe you got from the, you know, one of the fellows in the back of the room who always tries to throw you a left hook or something. But where does the, so in a traditional story, you've got the hero who eventually slays the dragon or, you know, reaches the, saves the kingdom or whatever like that. What is the role in your mind in that story structure of the actual charitable gift?
Sure. So when we're talking about the donor hero story, we actually go back to a professor by the name of Joseph Campbell, who's well known writing about the universal hero story, calling it the monomyth. And this is the idea that doesn't matter what culture you go to, there's going to be this hero story and it has universal elements. Now, let's think about those elements. The elements include that the hero goes forth. The hero struggles with a gatekeeper, enters a horrible place, undergoes an ordeal, then gains a reward or transformation and returns to his place of beginning with a gift to improve his world. Now, think about that classic story structure if we're talking about a successful entrepreneur giving to her alma mater. This is a person who goes forth, struggles, undergoes an ordeal, but the business is ultimately successful, gains a reward, and then she returns to her place of beginning with a gift to improve her world, giving back to her alma mater. Or perhaps a cancer survivor giving to cancer research. It's the same story structure. The hero goes forth, receives a diagnosis, enters a difficult place, undergoes an ordeal, hopefully gains a reward of remission or personal transformation, and then returns to that place of beginning again with a gift to improve his world. So this story structure, it's actually the same structure you would see in about every major epic movie ever, whether it's the original Star Wars or Matrix or The Hobbit. Now, I'll tell you, you know, you've got the reaction to this sometimes is to say, okay, You know, I've seen these movies, and I don't remember there being a fundraiser in any of these movies.
Yeah.
And I got to tell you, the reality is there is a fundraiser in each of these movies. And in fact, even in Joseph Campbell's Monomyth, there is a role. Now, he doesn't call it the fundraiser. He calls it the sage who challenges with a choice. So, for example, in the original Star Wars, this is Obi-Wan Kenobi. So in that script, Obi-Wan says, "You must learn the ways of the Force if you're to come with me to Alderaan." And Luke says, "Alderaan, I'm not going to Alderaan. I've got to get home. It's late. I'm in for it as it is." And Obi-Wan says, "I need your help, Luke. She needs your help." That is the fundraiser role, to be the sage who challenges with a choice. And whether that's Morpheus in The Matrix or Gandalf the Grey in The Hobbit, it's all about challenging with that heroic choice. Now, if fundraisers understand that that is their role in this universal hero story, it should tell us something about understanding the role and how we should feel about confidently asking big versus apologetically asking small. If we are giving someone the opportunity to be part of something bigger than themselves, which is fundamentally what we ought to be doing as fundraisers, we actually want to challenge people to a heroic level of involvement to match this core, universal, primal need for following that hero story in our own lives. So that's a little bit about those story element structures that come along and what the fundraiser role is in that universal hero story or monomyth. And we even get into some of the ways in which fundraisers that play this role, for example, those who ask to capacity. In other words, they don't come in with sort of the, "Oh, well, maybe we can get away with this smaller ask." No, no, they're challenging to heroism. Yeah. They're asking to capacity, and those fundraisers end up being the top fundraisers who bring in the dollars because they're appropriately fulfilling this role as the sage who challenges with the choice.
Right. And you know what? The other thing is, Russell, and you've been putting all this together. You've been piecing this together, and my mind's just now starting to piece it together. So thank you. But there's also that element of there's that inherent weakness that the hero oftentimes has. So oftentimes I have to imagine that the cause that the which has to get back to the donor's identity. My guess is that somewhere along that journey, the generosity journey, if we'll call it, we'll just call it that for nothing else to call it. But the journey to give generously and to give extraordinarily has to also be sort of their return, you know, sort of overcoming whatever that weakness is, which is oftentimes the way we sort of see our lives, sort of putting a cap on whatever that life journey that, wow, that's pretty profound. I'm going to have to look.
Yeah. You know, it really is this concept of returning to a place of beginning. That's why we want to ask donors these life story questions, because once we understand their place of origin, then we can lead them along that process to where they can see how a gift can actually be a return to that place of beginning with a gift to improve the world. So in that way, the fundraiser becomes a sage who comes alongside to help the donor construct and complete and advance their own personal donor hero story.
Yeah, very good. Russell, you've really given me a lot to, and I'm sure my listeners as well, but we could probably keep you going. I suspect with the people who were in the, in your session today, there were probably people who wanted to reach out to you. How would you encourage my listeners to reach out to you or find your stuff or go on your website? What would be your suggestion?
So the easiest way is anybody who links in with me on LinkedIn, I'll send you a message that has every presentation I've ever done, every academic journal I've ever published. I give it all away for free. I'm just a professor. I'm not selling anything. If you like this sort of thing, just Russell James at Texas Tech on LinkedIn and click that connect button, and I'll send you all of that stuff for free.
Okay, Russell. Well, this has been fascinating. You've certainly got me. I'm going to probably be reading up this evening, looking at my iPhone on story structure and how you incorporate that into charitable giving. So thank you. Enjoy the rest of the conference.
Thanks so much.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all-too-familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.